Well, friends, as you know, if you've been with us the last few weeks, we are in a series from the book of Exodus on the life of Moses. And we're going to continue that story today with Exodus chapter 2, verses 11 to 25. So if you have your worship folder with you, you can. There's a paper in there if you want to follow along, or you can just listen as well. Exodus 2, 11 to 25. One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Glancing this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day, he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known." When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now, priest of Midian had seven daughters. And they came to draw water and to fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up and came to their rescue and watered their flock. When the girls returned to Reuel, their father, he asked them, "Why have you returned so early today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." "And where is he?" he asked his daughters. "Why did you leave him? Invite him to have something to eat." Moses agreed to stay with the man who gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage. Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, "I have become a foreigner in a foreign land." During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out. And their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. On Tuesday, I had the privilege of visiting my daughter's first grade class. The teacher had put out a request earlier in the month for parents to come in and talk about their professions, what they did. Now, I was a little leery about accepting this, and I didn't take it up right away because I thought, man, what would that be like for a pastor in a public school? Would I be welcome? What would I say? Would some parents call and complain? What are they teaching my kid at that school? How would this go? But the more I thought about it, I thought, you know, I think I can talk about this in a way that's pretty inclusive, and so why not? And when I saw my daughter's face when I walked in and her smile, and she kept smiling the whole time, it made it all worthwhile. I was really glad I did it. But you know, first graders, they can ask some really interesting questions. So one of the boys in the class, he mumbled something, and I thought he said something about a password. And I said, "Huh?" And he said something more about a password. Later, I thought, I wonder if he was thinking about Peter and the pearly gates or something, but I think it had more to do with that he just wanted to go to the bathroom or something like that. He was just one of those kind of kids. Well, then the last question that I asked, the kid said, "Well, what do you like most about your job?" "Well, that's a really nice question. Thank you for asking," I said. And I had really talked about some of this earlier in my presentation, but I told him, I said, "Well, here's some of the things I really like. First of all, I like being part of a community, and there's all kinds of people in this community. And part of my job is to draw this community together and help connect them to each other and help it to grow and to thrive and to flourish. And I really like that part of my job." I said, "Other things about my job that I really like, you know, people invite pastors into their lives at some of the most important and significant times in their lives. For example, when somebody dies. Now, this is for sure not a happy time. But after they call the family, one of the first people they call is oftentimes their pastor. And it happened to me just this week. Somebody died Thursday morning, and at 9 o'clock, there I was in their home with the family. Again, not a happy thing to experience, but there's no question that this is a significant and important part of someone's life. People also see pastors oftentimes as trusted confidants, and so they will tell things to their pastor that they won't tell to anybody else. Things sometimes that they're maybe ashamed about or embarrassed about. People will also tell pastors things that they're really excited about and that they're really happy about, that they're proud about. And as an example of that, as a pastor, you get a, well, I was going to say a front row seat, but even better than that, when two people make sometimes the most important promises of their life, there you are right between them. And you get to pronounce them husband and wife. I had the privilege of marrying my sister, which sounds a little odd until you realize what that means is, no, I officiated at her wedding. And that's really cool. One of the things I like about my job. Really, as I thought about it, being a pastor, the things that you really like, that are most exciting about, are the ways in which you can make a difference in the lives of many, many people. And that has a way of making you feel significant. But, you know, as I think about it, this desire to be significant is really bound up in every human soul, isn't it? Doctors have a desire to be significant, and they do it by helping to sustain life and to heal people. Lawyers desire to promote justice and to bring justice into the world. Teachers to raise up new leaders. Parents, significance in raising happy, healthy, successful children. Engineers create new things. They invent new things that improve our quality of life. Tradespeople have a way of putting together things that we use every single day. Politicians desire to create order, and on and on and on you could go. Really, when it comes down to it, at your memorial service, at your funeral, what people will remember is not so much how much you made or how much you acquired for yourself or the comforts that you gained, but what they will talk about and remember are the ways in which your life made a difference, the way in which it was significant. Well, I wonder about Moses this morning. What kind of significance, what kind of difference did he hope to make in his life? We actually know from later chapters in Exodus and from some places in the New Testament that Moses was about 40 years old when this story took place, almost exactly 40. Now, this is kind of significant to me today, especially, because today is my birthday. It really is. And you know, first service day. Yeah. Thanks. They had me jumping because first service they sang right at a place in the announcements. And so I kept turning around thinking, when's it going to come? And it never came. So, you know, that just to keep you on your toes, they're good at that. So I felt a little distracted. But anyway, so you didn't even notice, I'm sure. But yeah, so it's my birthday today. And now I realize, so you say that, and now we really have to clear a few things up, or some of you will be really distracted for the next 10 minutes and won't pay attention, is my hunch. Because what you're wondering is how old is that guy? You know, like, where does he fit in relation to me, to how old I am? Am I about the same age as the pastor? Am I older? Am I younger? I don't know, you know. And so now that I've put that out there, we have to give an answer to that. So I'm 39 today. I turned 39 years old. And so now, though, here's what I suspect, though. So some of you, here's what I think some of you are thinking. Some of you are saying to yourself, oh, man, 39. He is so young. Oh. You know, I have kids that are younger than he is. He's just a lad. He's just a boy, just a young kid. I know that because some of you have said that to me. Others of you, though, are thinking, I suspect, dude, 39? That is old. That is like middle age. If it's not approaching middle age, it for sure is middle age. And you're saying, he's got kids and they're in school, and that is a whole different stage of life than I am in. 39? Yeah. And hopefully there's a few of you who are about the same age, maybe, and we can talk more about that afterwards. But enough about my age and my life. The reason I say that is because, well, Moses and I, we're kind of about the same age, I think, when this story takes place, and that's kind of interesting to me. 39, 40, they're about the same thing, right? Well, it depends how you see that, but Somebody said to me during first service, because I said, you know, middle age, he said, I'm middle age, and he was clearly older than I was, so I don't know if he appreciated that so much. But anyway, you know what they say about people who are almost 40 or 40 or early 40s is that this is really, you know, midlife, and this is the time when you have that, what they call that midlife crisis, you know, everything falls apart, and you buy new cars, and you get a new wife, and not recommending that, but that's what they say sometimes. You got time to go back to school, time to get a new job, things change in your life. It was in 1965 when Elliot Jacques first coined this term, midlife crisis, and he said it had to do with the fact that at about 40, you look around and you think, you know, my life just might be about half over. And it's real easy to look at people who, your peers most likely, who have achieved a little bit more than you, who are a little bit more successful than you, and you look at the trajectory of your life, where it's going, and you kind of get a sense for what you probably won't achieve, those dreams that you had at some point in your life. And all this has the sense of stirring up enough uneasiness in you that you have what has been termed a midlife crisis. So the question then maybe we could ask is, so I'm about 39, Moses is about 40, is Moses having a midlife crisis? Now maybe you think that sounds a little silly. I mean, this is of what, 4,000 or 5,000 years ago? Did people have that back then? Is this even really midlife? I mean, it sounds a little far-fetched. What would he even do if he had one? I mean, is it what, a new chariot? It's the latest in Egyptian weaponry, or I was imagining maybe that he got a new eye slate, you know, with an app for when the Nile was going to flood, and this was to replace the BlackBerry papyri were the things that were going out. You know, sounds a little crazy. Maybe you think the whole idea of a midlife crisis by itself is a little silly. I'm not so sure myself. Some researchers in the 80s said that fewer than 10% of the population has what could experiences what rightly could be called crisis. Whatever the statistics say, I think it is a fair question to ask and to wonder about this idea of making a difference in your life. Is your life significant? And I think it's also fair to say that at about midlife or at about 40 or wherever you think midlife falls, that those questions are a little bit more pronounced. So let's look at Moses' life a little bit and see how this all fits together. We learned last week that Moses, this is in chapter 2, was a fine boy. The text says he was fine. An alternate translation says that he was fair in the sight of God. Now, his mother was really desperate to do something about this fair young boy because, as we've said, Pharaoh was killing off all these young men, these Hebrew boys. And so she devises a plan whereby he will most likely or hopefully be found by Pharaoh's daughter. And what do you know? It works. Pharaoh's daughter comes down to the Nile to bathe, and there she finds this fine young boy in the bulrushes, and she pulls him out. Moses' name literally means drawn out of the water, and she adopts him and makes him her own son. Well, we can gather from this, it's pretty obvious that Moses then must have a pretty privileged upbringing. Moses grows up in Pharaoh's court. Moses has access to the best schools and to the best education. Any privilege that was available in ancient Egypt must have been available to Moses. And if Moses, as long as he didn't do anything to mess anything up, as long as he kept his, you know, followed all the rules, and even despite the fact that he was a Hebrew and had that in his pedigree, so long as he did everything right, there was a pretty good chance he could grow up and he would be a duke or a governor or a viceroy, some person with a significant place in this Egyptian kingdom. A life of privilege and of prominence and of significance was his to be had. But somewhere along the way, Moses obviously discovered his identity, discovered who he was, that even though he was a son of Pharaoh's daughter, even though he grew up in Pharaoh's court, that somehow his identity was wrapped up with those people that the text calls his own people, the people that Pharaoh was beating ruthlessly, torturing ruthlessly. And he probably saw it every day. And maybe he thought, I need to do something about that. Maybe, but it's tough to give up the comforts of palace life when everything's going really well. It is, isn't it? I mean, things have really got to be messed up for anybody in their right mind to throw away all of that, all that good that he's, all that safe, easy, comfortable, significant, prominent, well-tracked life that he is on. It's really hard to give that up unless things are really messed up. But then he hits 40. And who knows, maybe he was bored with the comforts of life in the palace. Maybe there wasn't enough excitement. Maybe things were just kind of ho-hum, or maybe it was just the fact that he knew inside himself that he wasn't Egyptian, but that he had ties to those Hebrew people that were being tortured, that he thought, I need to do something about this. I got to do something in my life that's significant, that will really matter, and possibly even save or rescue these people. And so Moses, he sees one of his kinsmen, one of his fellow Hebrew brothers, getting beaten and tortured at the hands of an Egyptian. And he's fairly calculating, isn't he? He looks to the left, and he looks to the right, and he's pretty sure that nobody's looking, and he kills that Egyptian, and he buries him in the sand. Kind of significant, huh? Significant enough to do something about whatever was stirring inside his heart, whatever made him snap, whatever made him commit that. Something was going on inside him, but not so much that would change the course or the trajectory of the life that he was already on. He buries him in the sand, and he goes about his way as if no one will ever know the difference. But somehow, somebody does see. Find out. We don't know who, we don't know how, but word does get back to Pharaoh. Moses has killed an Egyptian. You can almost imagine what Pharaoh might have said. I always wondered about that boy. He was a little bit too much like his father. He had that Hebrew inside of him, and I was never quite sure it was completely out of him. In fact, now we know where his true loyalties lie. He's just killed one of us. He hasn't just killed one of us, but he's killed one of Pharaoh's own men. This can really be called treason. This is treason in Pharaoh's court. And the penalty, the punishment for treason throughout all of human history has always been death. That's how it goes sometimes, isn't it? You know, you try to make a difference, really, and things go wrong. And I think that's why a lot of times some of us opt for the easy life all along. Make a difference, and try to do something significant, and it really has a cost to it, doesn't it? Try to serve somebody, and they might criticize you for it as you're doing it. Try to help someone, and so oftentimes you feel as if they resent you for your help. Thank you, but I can do it myself. Try to serve someone even just the simplest way, to bring them a meal, to give them a ride. And oftentimes you feel a lot more like an intrusion than any kind of help. Try to do anything significant and whoo bam. It's like, does this really matter at all? I mean, how many of us as parents haven't laid awake at night wondering about our own failures in raising our kids? Or how many business owners, business leaders lay awake at night wondering and thinking about, you know, they're overwhelmed by the monotony of employees that continue to undercut their leadership and make the process of getting a product to market a chore rather than a joy. Or the student who at the start of the semester is inspired and is excited by the syllabus, only 3 weeks later to be, you know, buried in piles of readings and papers that just don't seem to come together. Or maybe it's the sense of being lulled to sleep by yet another day on the same old, ordinary job. Why is it, why do so many of us, we might ask, who try to make a difference, end up spending so much time in the wilderness? It's because in the wilderness, in the desert, God starts to work. This is quite a story. It really is, isn't it? It's an amazing story, and I love how this plot unfolds. You go back a couple weeks ago, chapter 1. A new Pharaoh has come to power who does not remember Joseph and the deeds that he has done, and he begins beating and torturing God's people ruthlessly. But, we said, God was at work. God was at work in the beds of Hebrew husbands and wives, and they conceived and they gave birth to children that were strong. And the Hebrew people grew and they multiplied and they were strong people, so much so that Pharaoh was really scared, and he ordered to have all the Hebrew baby boys killed. But even in that, God was still at work, because he was at work in the lives of Hebrew midwives. And we talked about Shipra and Puah, who refused to kill these babies when they were born and instead allowed them to live. And then last week, the story narrows. We're talking about all of God's people, and then it comes and it focuses in on one family in particular, on one mother and on one child. And we see how this child is really miraculously saved, picked up by Pharaoh's own daughter and brought to live in Pharaoh's court. And as observers, as readers, we think, ah, this is it. This is the one. That's why the story came and focused on this one family in this one particular time. This is the person who's going to save God's people. This is the rescuer. This is the one we're waiting for. But then it's like one of those movies with an awful twist, and suddenly the hero has made an awful mistake, and it's going to take an hour longer to figure this all out as they get shoved off into some really awful circumstances. And that's what happens here. Moses kills an Egyptian. And there goes our hero, there goes our rescuer, on the run. And there he is, he's in the desert, and he's in the wilderness, and he's probably hiding by day, and he's running by night, and he's running, and he's running, he's running for his life. And finally he comes to a place where there's an oasis, and there's a well, and he sits down to catch his breath. Meanwhile, every good story, we say, has a meanwhile, doesn't it? Your text says, now there was a priest of Midian who had 7 daughters. Ooh. Well, that's kind of interesting. 7 daughters. Really? How does that fit? And he meets him at a well. And Moses, he hasn't appeared to have lost much of his edge from killing that Egyptian either, has he? Because there's some hostile, menacing shepherds in the area, and they're taking these 7 daughters, maybe we would say these 7 damsels in distress, and Moses has a way of standing up for them, and he shoos away those shepherds, and he helps water their flock, and things work out pretty good for Moses. He gets a good dose of some good old Midianite hospitality, and he gets a wife out of the deal at the same time. Not bad. Robert Alter has identified this scene, this particular piece of literature. He calls them a betrothal scene, and it's fairly fascinating. These are common scenes that happen in a lot of literature in this time period. And if you think you know the Bible somewhat well, you might be saying, "Yeah, hey, wait a minute, is it true that wells in the Old Testament times were great places to meet women and to meet brides?" And if you were thinking that, I would say, yes, you're right. It's true. Because we know of at least two other occasions where this has happened. One, Abraham sends his servants to find a wife for Isaac, his son. And he meets Rebekah at a well. And then Jacob, he's on the run, fleeing from his brother Esau, and he's going to the country where his uncle Laban lives. And he comes upon a well, and there is Rachel, is to be his wife. And it's almost as if wells in the Old Testament, they were like ancient Near Eastern pickup places. I mean, this is where you go to meet women, and you had these great pickup lines, you know, like, "Hey, can I get you some water?" You know? And they would, the reader would know this scene. They knew where this is going. It's like, "Oh yeah, this is the place where he asked her for some water." And that's when she's supposed to say, you know, and then fill in, and she says exactly what, and there it goes. The scene is significant because what it shows us is that God is still at work. That even in the midst of the wilderness, even in the midst of the desert, while Moses is on the run, it gives us a little bit of hope. Oh, this is good. God is at work here in this scene. It carries us along. It gives us a little bit of hope, but we are still in the wilderness. And it's quite clear that Moses' pain and his failure is really still with him. Moses' wife, Zipporah, gets pregnant, and she gives birth to a son, and she names him Gershom. Fine name for a young lad, right? Except it means stranger in a foreign land. Quite clearly, Moses had not forgotten where he had come from. And every day, Moses is reminded of the pain and the failure of his time in Egypt. Every day, you know, it's stranger in a foreign land. It's time to get up. Stranger in a foreign land, would you please eat your vegetables today? You know, stranger in a foreign land, if I've told you once, I've told you 1,000 times. Put your shoes, put your sandals on. We're going out to watch sheep. For 40 years, Moses was a stranger in a foreign land. For 40 years, Moses got to ponder his fate of what could have been. He was a prince in Egypt. He was the grandson of the king. And now, here he is in the desert, a shepherd. What difference does my life make after all? So we ask the question again, why is it that people who try to make a difference often spend so much time in the wilderness thinking that they are truly great failures? Pastor and author Craig Barnes says it this way: it's because in the wilderness times of life, we're not thinking about our heroism or our choices, and we can draw close enough to God to be reminded of his sovereignty. That it's God himself who is at work behind the scenes in our lives and in the lives of those around us. And it's God alone who makes the difference. The first time Moses tried to make a difference, his people, his own people, rejected him. Who made you ruler and judge over us? Just because you grew up in Pharaoh's court, just because you had a privileged life, just because everything was going so well for you, you haven't suffered the way we've suffered. And so they rejected him, and they sent him away. 40 years later, then God was ready to deliver and to rescue his people. And now that God was ready, Moses was called. See, Moses was called. Called to be what? Called to be a hero? Called to be a king? Called to be a savior? A rescuer? Moses, I think, most accurately we could say he was called to be a witness. A witness of what God had already done in his life and was going to do through him. God's first calling to Moses and to us is that we spend enough time in the wilderness to realize that first and foremost, we are witnesses to God's salvation. Nothing more and nothing less. Because what do witnesses do? Witnesses, they tell what they have seen and what they have heard. Witnesses tell us what they know. Witnesses, we say, they testify. I'm struck by how often we assume that we should have or we could have done more. We think it was our job to fix the situation. Our role was to offer guidance or advice. Our job was to hide or conceal our partner's vices because we thought that would help them thrive and flourish, when in reality all it did was aid and abet the vice all the more. We thought it was our job to come to our kid's rescue, that bully or that brat on the playground. We'll call the teacher, we'll call the principal, we'll tell the school a thing or two. We'll take care of it ourselves. It's so tempting to want to jump in and fix everything. You know what you should have done? Here's what you should have said. And we feel smart and significant and smug all at the same time. And all we're really called to do is to be a witness to God's work. Verses 23 through 25 of this text says, now during that long period, the king of Egypt died. Sometimes time has a way of healing things. Sometimes a new regime brings new hope. But in this case, neither was true. neither time nor a new regime changed anything for the plight of the Israelites. And the text says that the Israelites, they groaned in their slavery and they cried out. And their cry for help, because of their slavery, was heard because their cry for help went up to God. And the text tells us that God did four things. It said God heard their cry. God remembered his covenant that he had made, his promise that he made with Abraham and with Isaac and with Jacob. And God looked upon his people in their suffering, and God was concerned for them. God heard, God remembered, God looked, and God was concerned. Another translation says it this way: God heard, God remembered, God saw, and God knew. I like new better because it's the same new that's used in other places in the Old Testament, like in Genesis when it said, and Adam knew his wife Eve, and she became pregnant. Now, we're not implying a kind of sexual relationship here. What we are implying that God knew his people intimately. It's the intimacy that's being communicated here. That these were God's people. They belonged to him, and God knew their suffering as if it was his own. God knew. And God got to work. And God got busy. You know, Jesus spent, Chris read it for us earlier today, Jesus spent 40 days in the wilderness preparing for his ministry. The period of 40 in the Bible is often a period of redemption, a time of healing, a time of change, a time of preparation for what's to come. It's significant in that it points us in that new direction. Jesus spent 40 days in the wilderness preparing himself for his ministry. And then we also know that Jesus, when he hung on the cross, also cried out to God, and he said, God, why have you forsaken me? Do you hear me? Do you remember me? Did you forget? Do you know? The truth is that God did really know, because God knew in the person of Jesus, who became human, who lived and breathed and walked as one of us. And that same God who knew us in Jesus humbled himself to death, even to death on a cross. And we're witnesses to that death. We're witnesses to God's saving work in Jesus. But it doesn't even end there. Because we who today wait in our own deserts, in our own wilderness, also have the hope that's given to us in the book of Revelation. We have a hope of the wilderness that really someday is completely and ultimately transformed. Let's pray. God, what a story that you tell. What a story that you work in the life of Moses. And what a story that you work and are working in the lives of each of us here today. Remember us today. Hear our cry for mercy. And teach us to trust you wherever the wilderness brings us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.